Welcome to How To Medieval, the how-to where two guys show you how to do it between the two of them. Still got it. My name is Ari.
And I am Matt. Wait a minute, Ari. How To Medieval? I thought we had stopped this and we're doing something new.
We are, but we never did actually do a transition send-off, let anybody know that we were actually doing that episode, which we probably were remiss and should have done ages ago. So here we are.
Here we are. Back in the saddle again.
Back in the saddle again. So for those who have not noticed the transition by now, well, Matt and I have started a new show called Time Jaunt. We kind of got to the point where we were struggling to come up with episodes for How To Medieval because we feel like we were starting to recycle a lot of information. At some point, while I'm certain we can continue to refine certain points, I mean, we hit all of the major beats when it came to trying to give people that first bit of guidance they need to then springboard into living history. And so that's where we came up with you came up with the Time Jaunt version, which was, it kind of took the bumper rails off of what we could talk about, if you want to explain that a little more.
Yeah, so Time Jaunt, basically, we're not constrained to just the medieval. And people could tell that in the How To Medieval, we had been sort of wandering around to different eras and talking about that. But we always tried to sort of bring it back in a way to connect to the medieval. And doing Time Jaunt, we don't have to do that. I mean, we've had a few really good episodes talking about Romans, talking about just different history news.
Blue horses.
Popping up. Blue horses.
Yep.
Blue dogs. My wife and I, she's still talking about the blue dog for trying to figure out who the blue dog is.
Guys' blue dog was? Yeah.
But our blue dog. Anybody who doesn't get that.
Yeah, rejecting the floofer.
And anybody who doesn't get that reference, you need to go listen to the last episode of Time Jaunt that we just put out. So you'll get what we're talking about then. So we decided to just sort of, open the floodgates. We can talk about anything that has to do with history now.
Which is actually really liberating. And while I guess I in some way kind of missed the how-to, I back to our roots of a lot of us come to reenacting not just for the funny clothes, but because we like myth busting and explaining things to people. And we can still do that in a manner of speaking. Like, for instance, we have someone's interested in talking to us about their standing up their Greek reenacting troupe, and so we can talk a little bit. We can explore more of the how did they get there? What would you give someone in advice when they're going into like a much less well understood niche persona or time period, things like that? So Time Jaunt is a really good show for that whole concept. So I hope those who are listening here to How To Medieval and got super excited and aren't too terribly disappointed by the nature of this episode, pretty much telling them, we love you, we miss you, please come see us at our new show, are willing to come over to the new show.
Yeah, I hope people aren't like, yay, How To Medieval's back, oh no, it's just
right? That might have been part of the reason why we may have been subconsciously procrastinating that episode, because we do really care for our listeners, and we don't want to disappoint them too much, but you got to pull the cord on that sometimes. So here we are.
Yeah, we'd much rather be putting out high quality episodes of stuff we want to talk about than putting out mediocre episodes and struggling to find things to talk about. So, I'm really proud of what we did with How To Medieval. I think we did a really good job with it, and I think we're gonna do a really good job with Time Jaunt too.
Absolutely. And the thing about How To Medieval is that it remains relevant. And I mean, we haven't closed down the channel to the point where if there's some major, like, fundamental change in the culture or the community, or we've learned something that radically alters how we would have filmed a particular episode before, we can always do updates and throw things in there, because the How To Medieval, the collection is going to stay online, and it's still relevant and still useful for people to listen to, even if we're not actively producing new episodes on it.
Exactly. And so today, in part of this sort of send off, goodbye, everything, we do want to talk about an opportunity for a change in the medievalist realm here. And this is something that Ari has been working on a lot. And I'm sure any of you that follow Ari on any of his social media have seen him just releasing a deluge of videos and informational things about his new project. So I'm going to do, we're going to do a little something weird with the format today. I'm going to sort of interview Ari about what's going on. And this is going to be sort of his friendly warm up for a number of different podcasts that he's going to be going on this huge media blitz that he's doing for this project he's working on. So let's get into it, Ari. Let's just start. What?
All right. Happy to be in the hot seat.
What are you doing? What is this project that you are working on?
So for the few that the algorithm have hidden me from, the project is Dinthwaite Medieval Village. And right now I'm doing a Kickstarter to create the Dinthwaite Medieval Village Foundation. And the foundation is specifically designed to be the corporate structure, the independent nonprofit, and Kansas calls it not-for-profit, entity that will be used to administrate the village. And the village is meant to be a medieval living history and reenactment village, a place where we aren't competing with Renfair weekends, we're not fighting for space with wedding venues, we're not trying to make convention halls and hotel ballrooms and gymnasiums of the local high school pretend to be a place where medieval living history is happening. And we are going to build a village that is immersion focused and reenactment oriented. It's not going to be for the public. It's not going to be an attraction. It's not going to be a place where, you know, we can do things on this weekend, but then during the week, we can't have access to it. I hope to be able to allow reenactors to come in and do long-term enduring exploratory archaeology projects. Not everyone has enough space in their backyard to see how the growing and threshing and production of a archaic and period-specific brand of flax is done. But since this village will have field and farmland, that's something you can do. And well, you have to be able to access a field like that regularly to tend to your poll of crop. And you can't do that on just somebody's land. You know, there's problems when you have a guy who, or I like to call it dude with land, the problem. Like, it's great when we have it, but it's not reliable. We've all spent a ton of time pouring money and time into something that we then lose access to. Or the open air museum, you know, you have to comply with their rules and there's public hours. And while we could always tend something in plain clothes, we don't have an opportunity anywhere to have our exploratory archaeology projects also be immersion projects. So with this village, you know, if you have this gatehouse, which is the portal between the modern world and the actual medieval village, every time you come in, you get to do your craft and you get to do your farming or you get to do your exploration or you get to sit and read some treatises in a medieval hall. Like, these are things you get to do not just for study, but also for immersion. And I think there's a feel for the time period that probably none of us really understand how valuable that may be because we've never had an opportunity to try it. And I want to be able to try that.
What? That's a really noble, large, and in scope, noble project idea. How did you come about with this idea? How long have you been working on it? I know you've talked to me with snippets of ideas for a few years now, but what finally made you decide to sort of coalesce it into one big idea and start working on this?
So for everyone who knows from listening to me, I'm a spreadsheet kind of guy. So for years, like genuinely years, I wouldn't even be able to tell you how many back, as I would have these random ideas or random urges, or there'd be a campfire conversation about, man, if we could only do this, they would bounce around in my head. And when something bounces around in my head often enough that I want it to go away, I usually put it in a spreadsheet. And so I started to jot ideas down and notes into like WordPad, like, or not WordPad, but whatever the Google Keep notes is. And then I'd put them into spreadsheets. And that would allow me to like category them by like type of idea and its implementation. And then eventually the spreadsheet just got big enough that I had to describe what all this meant. And so that became sort of a summary addendum project. And then I kind of linked between the two. So like a cell would link to a heading in a Word document, and you'd be able to bounce around back and forth and find out what it all meant. And the moment of, okay, this should be something that's done, is when I realized that all of my notes and ideas and everything I had bounced off people over time and in like out of context, like, hey, I have this random question and I'm not going to tell you why, because in the idea it's coming from is this little fragile baby bird and I don't want it to break. When I realized that it was strong enough to be like, I can tell you why I'm asking this question, that's kind of how I just knew that it was time to move forward with making this a reality. And that's when I started to explore what is the problem? Why hasn't it happened before? What are our financial and logistic hurdles? And when I started to really dig into how I would address the mistakes of the past, it kind of just was like, look, I think I have a plan and I'm fairly confident it could work. So let's just do it. I mean, it's the time.
And you did finally earlier this month pull the trigger on that, and you started up the Kickstarter, right?
I did, yes. I had done a little bit of bouncing the idea off of places that may have been sponsored. I tried to maybe see like, okay, how much of this can we fund before? And the thing I ran into, which I wasn't actually terribly surprised by, was that most people, when you talk to like corporate sponsors and partnerships and such, they're looking to make money. And while the village has to make enough money to survive, it's actually counter to the very ideals of the project to do profit. Like, the idea is to not profit off of the reenactor, but to provide them a resource that they can access at little to no cost to be able to do better living history. And then the whole rising tide and all boats go up. So I was having what I wouldn't say is surprising trouble convincing people to invest money, because investors and banks want their money back, and I'm not trying to make money and I'm not trying to cut profit out of people to repay previous, you know, investors and such. So I thought, okay, community project, something that's meant to be, you know, for the reenactors, maybe we can go to the reenactors. And Kickstarter is the crowdfunding application that I feel is more fair, because if it doesn't fund, they don't charge you, unlike Indiegogo, which was the other big competitor. I just didn't see how it was noble or honorable to ask for people to give the money for this big project, and then if it fails to achieve the threshold that allows the project to function, I still get your money? Like, for what? Like, no rewards are happening, no forward progress is made, but I still get your cash. That didn't seem fair. So I chose Kickstarter because it's all or nothing. If it doesn't work, nobody gets charged. And by doing a Kickstarter and by doing crowdfunding, I can also say, okay, well, look, there's a need for this. There's a desire. It's more than just people saying, wow, that's a great idea, I'd love to go when it's done, but they're willing to put their money where their mouth is. And that will be social proof that I can then take to grant writing. I can take it back to those sponsors and those investors and be like, look, this is something that they want. This is something that you can derive value from as it progresses, because the need is here. But if the need isn't there, then all those other knock-on effects aren't going to manifest. And I mean, that gives me a good idea of where we're at with my current version of what I think the project could be.
So you're trying to approach this in a way to not have to charge reenactors, or charge them very little to come in and use the space?
Correct. So as a not-for-profit, the idea is not to create a business where I'm going to make money providing you a place to do living history. It's not a resort or not a venue. And that's why I think some people are confused, because it doesn't have to cost a lot. So say we crowdfund and get the land, like, there's going to be things like property taxes every year. Well, if we can raise enough money that we can, say, have an endowment that is invested conservatively, and that annual 3% or 4% that we get from that endowment pays for the property taxes, then the only reason that we'd want to charge the reenactors to come use it is either to make money for me or for future projects. And so if we want future projects to happen, then we can ask for people to contribute to those projects that they want to see happen. But if they are content with what they have right now, I don't understand why we should have to take people who already spent all their money on armor and wool and are going to have to travel, because while we're doing this in the Midwest because it's central to the U.S., honestly, the greatest strength and the greatest weakness of America is that it's gigantic. And so you're being close to everybody also means you're really far away from everybody still. So you have all these travel costs, the fact that reenactment itself is incredibly expensive. And so now what we're doing is, so you say a wedding venue or something like that, you want to do, they've got a pretty backyard and it's like a big farmland. You can do camping out there. Well, they're a for-profit business. They want to, if you're using that weekend and they could have put a wedding there, which was going to give them, you know, $25,000 or whatever these places charge, right? And they're going to do all the setup for you and they have all these rental things. And the whole thing is that they're there to make money. What I want you to do is I want you to come and learn and experience and then share that with your friends. And now the medieval living history, the entire culture has improved based off of your ability to experience something. And so what I would like to do is I would like to set the foundation up so that it is self-sustaining. Now, when I say little to no cost, obviously, if you're going to use more water, maybe you're going to use a little bit of electricity, things like that, like there'll be contributions for that. But I don't think that event fees are the correct structure for something that is supposed to be a resource. This is supposed to be like a physical library. You know, you go and you use it, and then you recontribute what you've learned back into the community.
So you must be trying to raise a ridiculous amount of money to do this, right? What's the Kickstarter you have going for?
So the whole plan could be up to $20 million, but the Kickstarter right now, this whole, let's set up the proof of concept, let's get the articles of incorporation, which are a very important part of this, reviewed by an attorney. All that is, I'm going for $25,000 right now. And that doesn't get us land, that doesn't get us buildings. But what that does is, as I said, it proves to outside investors, it proves to the skeptical people who look at this and say, oh, well, that would never work. No one even cares. Everyone would want to go, but no one would want to contribute. It gives them a sign of, okay, well, there's a ton of people out there because I set the minimum reward at $25. If you contribute less, you don't get a letter of patent, but anyone who contributes $25 or more gets a letter of patent that we are having designed, and it's being designed after an extant letter of patent. It's going to have original hand-done art on it. Concept sketches are going to come out as soon as we have them. Trent is still working on them now, but it's going to describe that you've contributed to the foundation of this village. It's going to have your name on it. I'm going to hand sign it, and it's going to have some wax seals, and it's the whole letter of patent look. It's going to be amazing. I can't wait to show some pictures of it. But if you think about the $25 mark, that's, you know, 1,000 people. If there's 1,000 people out there that are willing to spend $25 just to see this dream begin, then that's a great sign to other people that this is something that the community actually wants. We can take that for grant writing. We can take that for fundraising to larger donors. And what this does is it allows us to have the letters or the articles of incorporation and bylaws completely vetted by an attorney. We can have waivers and our business plan reviewed by an attorney. And these are all really important because those are what are going to separate Dinthwaite from just another dude with land. That's what the company is for. The company is for protecting the community against the capriciousness of private ownership. And then we also are going to have the beginnings of that, what I call the endowment style So we take the average cost of hosting a website, opening up a PO box, getting a phone, annual fees for things like the maintaining the corporation. If we take, I took out and I line itemed all of those things and said, okay, if I were to invest a pot of money at 3% interest every year, how much would it cost? How much would I need to keep those funds going, keep the website going, keep a mailing address, keep articles of incorporation on file with the state, and never have to charge anybody so that the every service we ever provide in the future, including everything that we'll be able to do on the website, because there's a lot we'll be able to do on the website before we even get land, all of that will be at zero cost to the average reenactor. Everyone will be able to use it regardless of whether or not they've contributed, which obviously that leads to herd mentality. But by doing this first Kickstarter at a small price point of $25K, we can prove that we can do the basic elements of what I say on the large scale are achievable. And I mean, there's something to be said for if I can't raise $25,000, then I'm not going to be able to raise $20 million. So it's a great litmus test, I guess.
So I mean, this is really ambitious and sounds like you've put, I know you've put a lot of thought into it. It's really well thought out with a clear direction you want to take it and path you want to go in. What kind of challenges are you having now? And what kind of challenges do you anticipate in coming up against in the future were you to move forward with this?
Well, the biggest challenges, of course, are the funding itself, you know, having people pay for something that has never been done before. And so there's a lot of faith in from people going, okay, you know, if you're trying something completely new, then there's really nothing to framework it off of. This isn't like Gidelon or the Ozark Fortress. This isn't like, what is it, Dalwhinnie? I think I'm saying it wrong. It's not like a lot of the reenactment village, quote, projects that have happened in the past. It's specifically designed to take all those things that didn't work and improve upon them and come up with answers to those. And so since nothing, as far as I can tell, everything I've researched, every site plan that someone has sent to me, every successful and failed project in the past, none of them function like this. None of them are designed to be specifically a at-use resource so that people can do immersion projects in medieval environments without a bunch of other constraints and concerns. So getting people to understand the project in the first place and communicating my vision, I guess, because there's this seesaw, I guess, of between it's the internet, you got to keep it quick and punchy, 30 seconds, you're going to lose their attention, versus I can talk about this for days on end, right? So there's so much to explain, and realistically, people's feed only gives you so little time to really, truly convert all this information to something that they understand. Not that people have a hard time understanding things. It isn't a critique on people's intelligence. It's just we only have so much time, and the way that the news feed goes, you know, 30 seconds, you got to hook them. It used to be 30 seconds. Now it's 10 seconds. If you don't have that hook in your first 10 seconds, your TikTok's going to die kind of thing. And so that's a major hurdle, obviously, convincing people that I'm not trying to fleece them or that this isn't doomed to inevitable failure, and so they're wasting their money. There will be difficulties when it comes to making sure that the immersion is balanced correctly with required, I guess you call it, regulations and codes, accessibility, things like that. I've got a couple people who have contributed some of their thoughts on the best way to make sure that we don't have some painfully non-medieval elements, but also don't like break the law or put people in clear danger of harm. And obviously there's going to be some interaction with county governments that I really don't understand, which is why I'm aiming for my local community, because I happen to be fairly plugged into local government, not as a part of local government, but you know, there's commissioners I know by name. I have a familiarity with people at the appraiser's office, and most of the county government I'm at least vaguely familiar with. And so I feel like I'm not going to say I can grease the wheels, but I think I can communicate with these people in my local area better than if I just randomly picked a place and went like, okay, I want to build this here, and they have no idea who I am, and I have no idea who they are or how they think. You know, I just, those are going to be challenges. Future fundraising is going to be challenges. I want to defray as much future fundraising as possible from the reenactor by going through grants and sponsorships, but every time, every one of those is its own challenge. Grants are highly competitive. There's going to be skepticism amongst those corporate sponsors and whatever you call them, strategic partnerships that don't want to just throw their money down the drain. So whenever you're asking people for their money to something that they're not getting an immediate gratification for, it's not like I'm going to buy something on Amazon, it's going to ship in 2 days. You know, I get it. Like, okay, I'm offering a highly detailed, very valuable, what I would consider far in excess of the $25 value of a piece of art when it comes to the letter of patent. I mean, there's still that sense of risk, and future or the higher tier awards have things like we're designing a plaque that's going to be sort of styled like a coat of arms, and that's going to go up in the village. But then, of course, that's another defrayed reward because the plaque is going to come when the village comes. And so things, my thought behind the plaque was, you know, you go to the zoo and the donors have their little plaques, you know, we just opened up the aquarium at the Kansas City Zoo, and, you know, they're shaped like fish and sea turtles, and people who have donated to that building get their names on the wall. And I feel that that's it is a well versed and proven reward that people want. But the question is, are there people who feel that they're never going to see that anyway? So that's a challenge.
You touched on it briefly. Let's really get sort of pick this apart and what time we have left here for a minute. You mentioned the Ozark Fortress, and you mentioned the place in France and Delaney Fields, and you know, there's these things have popped up all over the place, and a number of them in the United States, and they've never really seemed to get much traction. So how is what you're doing different from what they're doing, and how do you think you're going to get more traction than they did?
Well, they're different in three major ways, and some of them are successful and some of them aren't, but the perspective we have to talk about is from the perspective of a reenactor. Are they successful in regards to being able to do immersion events? And most of them are not, because the majority of them are attractions. Their goal is to bring in public. They want tours, they want school groups, they want corporate team building events. The idea is to bring in the public in the same way that Worlds of Fun wants to bring in the public, or a store shop wants to bring in the public. And so when it comes to their success or not success as a reenactor, their public appeal is in direct conflict with my desire to not have people in Bermuda shorts with a camera hanging around while I'm doing stuff. And that kind of happens with open air museums as well. There's lots of really great open air museums where you get to go and do, you can be a living history interpreter. And so you get to wear the clothes and be in the environment, but you're not doing living history projects in that you are doing everything oriented towards presenting to the public. It's kind of like a timeline event. And while that's awesome, it's not immersion. And so I want there to be a space where not just the events are immersion. And then we've also seen in the past where people are, it's like I said, the dude with land problem, wherein some guy has, and it's usually a guy, I'm certain there's ladies out there who bought land, but the concept of having someone who is in the scene who owns land and then allows people to do stuff on the land, always, you know, multiple times we get hit with putting time and money into these places where then that person dies, that person loses their job, they move away, their job changes, and then we lose access to the site. People who inherit it don't want to use it for that purposes. There's some liability or insurance issue. They're sick of paying the higher premiums, and then it all goes away. Or because it's just owned by some guy, it's not a place where people can come at their interest. It's a place where they come when the guy wants them there, and so it becomes these tiny little fiefdoms that cluster around the community that one individual tends to foster. And I want this to be it needs to transcend group lines. It needs to transcend organizational lines, and it needs to be something that everyone in the community can access. And that's where the corporation comes in, because it won't be me owning this. I will just be the first steward of this organization that is supposed to be multi-generational. And that's why this first step of having the very strict articles of incorporation and bylaws that will prevent mission drift and will prevent people from using it for non-visionary purposes. You just write those rules into how the organization runs, and then those rules are set in place for whoever takes it over after me, because eventually I'll retire, or I'll get old, or something will happen, and you'll need to move on to somebody else. And then that's how I translate the vision that people deserve to endure onto the next caretaker.
Wow, that, like I said before, you've really put a lot of thought into this. What are you hearing from people? You've been doing a lot of stuff out there. You've been answering questions every day, multiple questions every day. You're putting out new videos. What are you hearing from people about it? What kind of buzz is getting generated?
I mean, there's a lot of support. A lot of people who say it's a great idea. A lot of people who say they'd love to be there when it happens. I've gotten, I wouldn't say pushback so much. There has been a fair amount of skepticism, people who are not certain how it'll work, or and people either just reading the headline and not reading the guts of the explanation out there. Obviously, there's only so much time you have to watch the entire corpus of videos I've got going. A lot of people who are confused, I think. They think it might be, they see it as another thing like Gidalon. A lot of people are like, oh, wow, that'll make for a great place to do movies, and it'll be a great place to bring school groups, and it'll be a great place to have weddings, and you should turn the cottages into Airbnbs. And so that is what I would call the default thinking that has led to the failure of this kind of project over and over again, is that eventually, if you say, okay, we want to focus on doing all those other events, now there's no place for the reenactor again. And it has to be reenactor first. It has to be reenactor only. And that obviously limits my pool of people that I can draw money from, of course. So there's that conflict. A lot of people they think it is a different project than it's supposed to be. And so I've been trying to refine my ability to communicate what it actually is to people. But I mean, a lot of positive feedback. We have about 18 backers as of the 19th, and we've got a little over 40 days left to go. So there needs to be a huge spike in the people who contribute. There's a lot of people who I think are intimidated by either Kickstarter or about the fact that there isn't land yet, which I personally find, I find it ironic that there are people who are like, oh, well, if you're not buying land, then why would I contribute? But if I had set the Kickstarter at 20 million instead of 25,000, I don't think that they would find a different reason not to contribute. That's way too risky. I'm not going to roll the dice on that. So I feel like I'm stuck in the in-between, because every time that I say, oh, well, I'm not going to do the whole 20 million in one go for all these great practical reasons, there's like, oh, well, if you're not actually going to provide any services, then I'm not going to contribute. And then, so I feel like either side, if I had started in either direction, there's lots of people who love the idea, want to be there and will come when it happens, but aren't willing to contribute on this end. And then there's been a lot of people who are just like, look, like my life circumstances, I can't, but I'm going to share your posts and I'm going to talk about it with my friends. And that's awesome, because buzz is key. I just think that there's obviously the issue with the internet itself wanting to pay for exposure. And that has caused me some consternation, because I know that there's people even in my timeline who, when I ask them questions about it, are like, I didn't even see this come up. I was like, man, well, I've posted like 16 times in the last 4 days. Like, how could you not have seen this? But
yeah, that's something that's happening a lot with a lot of content creators right now, especially on Instagram. They're seeing like anything that has to do with a sword is suddenly being restricted. So that's being something to fight with there. I don't think it's something to do with having a castle is being restricted, but or a village, but yeah, that's a lot of people are being restricted right now.
I feel like the internet knows, kind of can sniff out when you're asking for something like, oh, I'm trying to get money out of people. And then they're like, I want my cut of that first. And because I actually posted a comment the other day on Facebook about how it's ridiculous how many ads I see versus, like, it was literally one post on my feed was something I cared about, and then there was 8 consecutive sponsored posts. And that post, complaining about it, got more comments, reads, likes, and exposure than most of the other actual promotional content. And that's, I think, because Facebook sniffed out that it wasn't actually selling anything, so it didn't care to force me to pay for exposure.
Mm. Yeah, that's something.
Jaded, yeah. Conspiratorial.
As somebody who does try to do a lot of fundraising through Facebook, I feel it. I feel your pain.
Yeah.
So what haven't we talked about this project? What's something that you want people to know about this project?
I want people to know that this project isn't for me to create a little fiefdom of my own where people come and play at my leisure. This is genuinely designed to be something that, and that's, again, I have to stress that the purpose behind creating the incorporation is that this becomes a project that belongs to the community. And I want them to have a place unlike anything that they have had an opportunity to experience before. And realistically, we always talk about, ooh, there's these medieval towns and castles, and look at the people in England and France who get to take all these great pictures and these living history troops. But they're doing it in front of old buildings, ruins. They have modern cars, and the villages that spring, and the actual buildings that spring up around these old villages. There are very few places, if any, that have the experiences I'm willing to offer people, and there isn't any in the US. And I think that we, the American reenacting scene for medieval, has this opportunity, I think, to make Europe jealous of us. And there's not a lot in the living history scene that especially in the medieval eras, that Europe is particularly jealous of us about. And I think that'd be great. And I think that it would be, I think the knock-on effects of what we could achieve when it comes to understanding history by doing it in a completely immersive environment are, I mean, we don't even know what could come from it, because no one's had an opportunity to experience that, not on a regular basis. So I want people to know that therein lies my desire, my goal, and that I'm trying to do this for them in the same way that everything else I do online is for their enrichment and their entertainment. The website that I've done before through Turnip of Terror, and all my content online is explicitly towards improving the reenactment culture in general. And this has that exact same mission. It's just bigger and more expensive than I've tried in the past.
And what happens if this one doesn't get funded? What's the next move?
Well, I take a moment to experience disappointment, and then I do what I do when I don't like the outcome of something. I grip my teeth and go back to the drawing board, find what happened wrong, and address those problems. Instead of just pounding my head against the wall, I say, okay, well, what was wrong about this? You know, it's just like a math problem, or just like a complicated spreadsheet. Like, where is the error in my formula? What's wrong with the code? Not what's wrong with them for not doing it the way I want, but how did I not create my message appropriately? How did I not express my vision? What part of my vision are truly untenable? And then I either start, do another Kickstarter, attempt different methods of fundraising. But the idea is, if this Kickstarter does not work, we're not going to flip the table and pout and go home and say, you all suck. I'm going to critically evaluate what it was that was the failure. Was it simply because I'm a reenactor and not a marketer? Is it because there are fundamental flaws in my plan that turned people away? And I'll just have to tear my own work apart and find out what didn't appeal or what doesn't work. And if I can find a fix to it, I move forward with that fix. And if there is no fix to it because it's not a correct way to go about doing this, well, then I guess I make more transition videos on TikTok.
You're always welcome on TikTok.
That's right.
Well, Ari, thank you for answering these questions today.
Of course.
I, of course, have already, I've put in my $25. I'm invested in this. I think it's a great idea.
And a scholar.
And I want it to succeed. So, of course, anybody who has any questions for Ari, you can always reach him through his Turnip of Terror social media accounts. You could reach him through either, I think the old howtomedieval at Gmail still works. If not, you can reach us also at timejauntshow@gmail.com. That's our new email for the new show, which I hope you all come join us and listen into that. And go check out the Kickstarter. He'll post a link in the show notes, of course. And let's make some great medieval stuff happen here in the U.S.
Thank you, everybody.
All right. Bye.
Bye.